Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For the first 25 minutes of this final hour, we'll be talking with Dr. Ralph McKenzie, co-author of the book Roman Catholics and Evangelicals, Agreements and Differences, about a statement drafted by Roman Catholic bishops, some of them, and Jewish leaders, called Reflections on Covenant and Mission, or for short, Covenant and Mission. We'll find out what this statement had to say about the evangelization of Jews in just a moment. In the next part of the hour, our good friend Uwe Simonetto joins us, religion editor for United Press International. We'll get a roundup on several religion news items with Uwe. Always an enjoyable time talking with Uwe, jumping from subject to subject as we do. You can join us as well. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our first guest, Dr. McKenzie, has also written an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled Document Rejects Roman Catholic Evangelization of Jews. Dr. Ralph McKenzie, welcome back to Issues Etc. It's been a while.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you very much. And while I appreciate the distinction of being called doctor, I do not deserve it. So please just call me Ralph.
I will call you Ralph there anyway. Tell us about this document. Who drafted Covenant and Mission, and what did it say?
Well, one of the problems that we face as Christians is that oftentimes we rely on the secular media to give us guidance and direction, and they take us astray. And they've done so in this particular situation. It did not come directly from the bishops, the Roman Catholic bishops. It was a study group that was put together by some bishops and some liberal and less than Orthodox Jewish groups as well. And the bottom line here is these progressives or liberals were saying that it is no longer incumbent on the Catholic Church to present the gospel to the Jewish people because they are all already in the covenant. You may be familiar with the old two-covenant theory that was promoted a while back, which said that it wasn't necessary to evangelize Jews because they were also in a covenant with God. And so this is just a revival of that position. It's not an official statement, but it certainly caused a lot of controversy when it came out and was reported on in the secular press.
So we need to consider the source here, I take it, that we're not talking about the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and we're not talking about representatives of Orthodox Judaism or Hasidic Judaism. We're talking really about, you said progressive, but the more liberal wing of both of those groups.
Exactly. You're exactly right. The Catholic bishop who was directly involved in this was Cardinal William Keeler of Baltimore. I don't wish to be disrespectful, but Cardinal Keeler is not noted for his theological acumen. He is more of an organizational person, and he was forced to backtrack on this, as my article points out later on.
Now, the simple question might be, because I mean, once you get into the realm of liberal or progressive Judaism to the reform and the conservative wings of Judaism, you do progress more and more toward universalism. The more pressing question might be, do the bishops who signed and drafted this statement does this statement in any way represent the official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church about evangelizing Jews?
Absolutely not. And no bishop signed this. In fact, even the more progressive Catholic bishops were embarrassed by what this study group came up with after it was examined by their more orthodox fellow bishops and fellow cardinals, and they had to back off. You see, this was just one of those things that happened. It was not official. No cardinal, no bishop signed it, and it was quickly criticized by more conservative Orthodox people in the Catholic Church.
With that said, is it safe to say that there are, in fact, bishops and those in the Roman Catholic Church who do hold to this two-covenant theory and to the contention that the Roman Catholics and other Christians need not evangelize Jews because they have essentially a non-Jesus track to heaven?
Regrettably, the answer to your question is yes. I don't know how many bishops would hold this, but there are a large number of progressive Catholic theologians, or perhaps I should just say a number, of Catholic progressive theologians, not only throughout the world, but also in the United States, who would take this position. One of the more notable would be Richard McBrien, who used to teach at Notre Dame. He was the chair of the theology department. I'm not sure if he's still there. I know he still teaches, but he might be emeritus and just teach a course once in a while. But he would certainly be very comfortable with this. But this is not a position which is held by traditional Catholic teaching, and as I've already said, has been rejected by a number of Catholic theologians.
Other than theological reasons, why do you believe it would be in the interest of progressive Catholic bishops, and in particular of leaders of the more progressive wing of Judaism in America, to come together in a statement like this? What's behind this?
Here's what's behind it. It's basic, synchronistic, minimalistic approach to religion. We're all going up the mountain, but on different sides. God is like your bearded, kindly grandfather at the top of the mountain, and he is welcoming every particular religious manifestation that we have, and it really doesn't matter what you believe, only that you believe in something. Now, that's put quite simply, but that's basically what the motivation is. And it's found in, as you say, liberal Judaism, and it's also found, regrettably, in Christianity, the mainline denominations, and the Unitarianism, Universalism, the New Age movements, and so forth. It's just a common, minimalistic approach to religion. Your religion is as good as mine. What's true for you is true for you, but not necessarily true for me. And it's an Enlightenment approach from a historical perspective to a religion in general.
Does a statement like this, like covenant and mission, does it further the what's becoming a more popular viewpoint among Christians and in the culture generally, that Christian evangelism is, especially when carried out toward Jews, is anti-Semitic, and that it is an act of intolerance in general?
Yes, indeed. That's a motivation that could be found. Now, let me read to you a statement made by one of my favorite Orthodox Jewish rabbis, Rabbi Daniel Lapin, and I quote, I have this quote in my article. Rabbi Daniel Lapin once commented that asking a Southern Baptist not to attempt to evangelize Jews is like asking a Jewish family they cannot have a kosher kitchen, or they cannot circumcise their male babies. And that's a very powerful statement, because it doesn't come from a Jewish liberal, but it comes from a Jewish Orthodox rabbi, who says that evangelization is at the warp and woof of Christianity. He mentions the Southern Baptist Convention because the statement came out after the Southern Baptists were taken to task for trying to evangelize Jews several years ago. But this holds true for any Christian denomination, any Christian group which feels like Jesus, who feels like Jesus is the is the only Savior, and it's our responsibility to make that known throughout the world. So here is a rabbi who is saying that this is perfectly correct, because because this is a part of our faith commitment.
We're talking with Ralph McKenzie. He's co-author of the book Roman Catholics and Evangelicals, Agreements and Differences. Ralph has written an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled Document Rejects Roman Catholic Evangelization of Jews. Now, to be absolutely clear, the drafters of this statement really meant to speak only for themselves and perhaps, you know, to make a statement for Roman Catholics in general. Did they mean to say that, say, the Southern Baptist, you mentioned them, or my Lutheran church body, in their attempts to evangelize Jews, are in some way crossing the line or being intolerant or doing something that's unnecessary?
Yes. They said it implicitly. They didn't directly say it, but one could draw the conclusion that if this document is correct, and if it's correct for the people that were directly involved in its formation, that those of us that are more fundamentalistic or more orthodox should pay attention and should decide to direct our attention to other things rather than evangelizing the Jews and by extension, evangelizing other religions as well.
So it would extend beyond simply, I mean, the premise of this is a two-covenant theory with regard to Jews and Christians, but you do have to ask the question, where do you stop or where do you start doing evangelization?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're exactly right. That's implied in it. And I should say that that the Catholic response to this, the Orthodox Catholic response, was very, very swift. Cardinal Avery Dulles, who, in my estimation and the estimation of a lot of other people, is probably the premier Catholic theologian, immediately addressed this question of this document and said it was completely a false premise, and it did not have any roots in traditional Catholic doctrine. And he was very, very critical of it. And not only Cardinal Dulles, but also others as well. Carol Keating, who is the founder of Catholic Answers, said that this notion that the permanence of God's covenant with the Jews implies that they do not need Christ to be saved, that their covenant is sufficient, and that the Christian covenant is superfluous for them. The result, Keating notes, is, quote, that the desire is not to injure feelings, trumps clear thinking, and does a disservice to Jews, who, like everyone else in the world, need Christ. Close quote.
What has been the Protestant response to this document?
Well, the Protestant response, you might realize, is that the liberals thought that it was a pretty good document. And the Southern Baptist response was also a vigorous a rejection of this and would agree with Cardinal Dulles' response. I might also mention that not only Cardinal Dulles, but Cardinal Ratzinger, who is probably second only to Pope John Paul himself in the Roman Catholic Church, very clearly rejected this. And in several different venues spoke to this question of evangelizing Jews and said that that the close ties between Judaism and Christianity, notwithstanding, in point of fact, because of their close ties, because the Jews look for a Messiah, that the claims of Christ should be presented to them in a very forthright manner. And so here you have two leaders, Cardinal Dulles and Cardinal Ratzinger, who came out and were very, very critical of this document.
Does the response of Joseph Ratzinger, does it amount to a papal response to this document? He is, after all, of the Vatican Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith.
Yes, he is. Yes, it is. What Cardinal Ratzinger says is certainly the voice of the present pope, and he was very, very clear. The Vatican response, I'm trying to here on December the 2nd, 2002, in Spain, Ratzinger addressed an audience of 3,000, which included some world-renowned theologians, on the topic, is it arrogant to say Christ is the only Savior? And Ratzinger said, quote, in reality, the arrogant one is the relativist. Real arrogance is wanting to take God's place and determine who we are. Therefore, the only thing that we can do is not proclaim ourselves, but speak with holy fear of what is not ours, but of what comes from God. You see? So he very clearly states that the position of the Catholic Church has not changed, that Jesus is the Savior who should be presented to all people. Now, you can. He also says that we must present the gospel in humility and in gentleness and in compassion, and there are acceptable and non-acceptable ways to preach the gospel, but that doesn't mean that we don't preach the content, preach the essence of the gospel.
You mentioned in your story Dominus Iesus, a declaration of the unicity and salvific universality of Jesus Christ and the Church. It was a papal encyclical very yeah. recently, and got pressed for other reasons, because I think Dominus Iesus refers to non-Roman Catholic church bodies as ecclesial communities or something like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Laying that aside, what does that document have to say with regard to the need to evangelize Jews and others?
Dominicus Iesus takes exactly the opposite track of the statement that we're talking about here, and that document was formulated to address syncretism and universalism in the Roman Catholic Church itself, and the Pope very, very clearly denounced this whole attempt to water down the gospel. And said that Christ is the only Savior, and he said it in very, very clear terms. It could have been written by Jerry Falwell or Oswald Hoffman, to take somebody from your tradition. A very, very clear proclamation that Jesus is the only way to God.
Now, this document, drafted by just a small group of progressive Catholic bishops and a small group of progressive Jewish leaders, comes at a rather unfortunate time for the Roman Catholic Church, and some may not see the connection, but you do mention it in your article that this is at a time when trust in the hierarchy of the church, in the bishops of the church, is really at an all-time low. What do you make of a release of this kind of document, making a very dubious theological statement, when, for other reasons, the bishops are being called into question?
Well, I'm not sure there's a connection, although there are people who would be sympathetic to both situations. First of all, sympathetic to the announcement that Catholics don't have to evangelize Jews, and also very, very critical of the Roman Catholic hierarchy in this whole sorry business about sexual misconduct. And by the way, I have a number of friends in the Orthodox Catholic side of the house, and they are equally disappointed and enraged with the way the bishops have gone about what they've done in the sexual misconduct side of the argument. But there are some people that are taking great a great deal of comfort in the problems that the Catholic Church is facing. And it's a very complicated issue. It would take another article to address it, and I'm not sure that I'm the one to do it, because I think that Orthodox Catholics themselves have been very, very clear on this. And may I tell you about someone in your area who could address this very, very well, and his name is Dr. James Hitchcock. And Dr. Hitchcock teaches at St. Louis University.
He's been a guest regularly and in fact, recently on that very subject on this program.
Oh, he's a very close friend of mine. He's been at my conferences. I have an organization called the San Diego Christian Forum here in San Diego. He's been with us twice. He's very articulate, very clear, and he works well with evangelicals, always has. And he's a very, very Orthodox Catholic. And I would recommend his writings to your listeners. And he's the senior editor for Touchstone magazine, which I get. As a matter of fact, I was reading Touchstone when my phone rang for your interview.
It's a good magazine. We often interview some of its editors and also authors for it. Finally, there's one other concern about this document, Ralph, about covenant and missions. We've only got about a minute and a half here before we have to go.
Sure.
And that is that it does talk about evangelization, but only in terms of commitment to social development and liberation, sharing mutual gifts, things like that.
Yes.
And that's how it classifies evangelization.
Yes.
Sounds like a social gospel to me.
It is a social gospel. It is. And the Orthodox Catholics would point that out immediately, and would say, while good works and while works of charity and works of compassion are part of the gospel, and I would say the same thing as well as a committed evangelical, they are not. This is not evangelization. Evangelization is presenting the fact that Jesus Christ has come to save sinners from hell and to convey them to heaven. You see, and whereas social activity, good works, and so forth are incumbent upon the Christian, they are in addition to, not in lieu of, preaching the gospel.
Ralph McKenzie, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me, and whenever I can be of help, please call.
We'll certainly have you back. Ralph McKenzie is co-author of the book Roman Catholics and Evangelicals, Agreements and Differences. He's also written an article in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal titled Document Rejects Roman Catholic Evangelization of Jews. You know, there's a quotation here from Ralph's article from Pope Paul VI. It was a statement that he issued in 1975, in which he says, there is no true evangelization if the name, the teaching, the life, and the mystery of Jesus are not proclaimed. You see, one way to get away from evangelization is simply to redefine it, to say, well, what we're really talking about is making this world a better place. And we can do that with Jews. We can make them, together with them, make this world a better place, and we'll call that evangelization. But that turns the definition of evangelism on its head. Evangelism has at its heart the evangel, the gospel message, the good news, and there is only one good news, and it's not good works and making the world a better place. The only good news there is the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ for you. We'll be right back.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Can God's ways be generally understood by human reason? Is God's favor manifested in life's successes and victories? Is God pleased by sincere human effort? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, host of Issues, Etc. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues, Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled, The Theology of the Cross, Cross-Shaped Theology. The latest issue also contains articles titled The Means of Grace, A Confident and Joyful Heart by Pastor Eric Rotman, Living in Two Kingdoms, Peace or War, Order or Chaos by Pastor Mark Sell, and Craig Parton's essay From Evangelicalism to the Evangel. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources. You can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. Journal by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172 or write Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
The Bible, is it really relevant today?
Answers with Ken Ham, one of North America's best-known Bible conference speakers. Well, Ken, is the Bible really relevant for our modern times?
You may find this hard to believe, but I've met many pastors and theologians who say the Bible needs reinterpretation in every age, but especially today. Otherwise, they say, it wouldn't be relevant for that particular culture. You know, I've often wondered why they even think this way. Then it finally hit me. You see, many of these theologians and pastors have accepted evolutionary beliefs, and they believe that man is evolving. So as a result, they believe that our theology must evolve as well. But evolution's not true, and Genesis is literally true. Genesis is the foundation to all of our Christian doctrine. And you see, the Bible is just as relevant today as it was hundreds of years ago. The nature of man hasn't changed. Man's still a sinner, and he's in rebellion against God. In fact, if anything, man is much worse off today than he was hundreds and hundreds of years ago, because things are running down as a result of the curse. If you have to reinterpret the Bible in every age, it means there's no such thing as absolute truth. So truth changes all the time. This would make the Bible absolutely meaningless. And sadly, many teenagers in our church today think this way.
Does the Bible even have the answer to racism and the question of where the races came from? Find out more when you go to our website, AnswersRadio.com, and read Ken Ham's free booklet. That's AnswersRadio.com.
5:31 at AM 850 KFUO. Weather for St. Louis tonight, mostly clear. Low of about 72 for Thursday, mostly sunny. A high near 93, a nice afternoon on the way tomorrow. Right now, scattered clouds, and it's 84 in St. Louis. The guest for the last half hour of Issues Etc., Uwe Simonetto. He and Pastor Todd will talk on various religious issues. Another look at St. Louis traffic. Westbound 40 between Boyle and Hampton, heavy traffic. Also slow west of 270 to Mason. Southbound 270 between Ledoux Road and Doherty Ferry. There's some slow traffic there. Westbound 44 is heavy and slow from Lindbergh to 270. Eastbound 270 between Lindbergh and 170, some slow traffic. Northbound 55, south of 44, an accident is blocking the right lane and traffic is getting by on the shoulder on the ramp to westbound 44. Also eastbound 44 is backed up to Jefferson.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. Well, we'll take care of the condiments for your 4th of July weekend with Judy DeMoisey of the world's largest ketchup bottle and Barry Levinson of the Mount Horeb Mustard Museum. And we'll talk with Colonel Jeff O'Leary about his book, Brave Hearts Under Red Skies, Stories of Faith Under Fire. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking about American civil religion. Now, at the outset, you look at that. There are three. American, that's good. I like American. Civil, everyone wants to be civil. And religion. Sounds like those three are three good things. Is American civil religion the same thing as Orthodox Christianity? Does the church exist to serve the purposes, the ends, the goals of the state? Is America a Christian nation? Is there any sense in which we can call America a Christian nation? We'll talk about American civil religion with Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute tomorrow on Issues Etc. Our guest in the last 25 minutes, Uwe Simonetto, is religion editor for United Press International. We'll be talking with him about several religion news items. You can join us as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Uwe, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Nice to be back.
You have been a reporter, and you were a wartime reporter in Vietnam. I think you told me in a previous conversation you were an embedded reporter before there was even such a term as an embedded reporter. There have been comparisons made lately and in the past between the conflict in Iraq and the conflict in Vietnam. Is there any comparison?
Yes, only in one sense, but one sense alone, and that is in the potential danger in the way the public will perceive this conflict as a constant drain. Every day now you hear and hear the news of 1, 2, 3 Americans being killed as a guerrilla warfare. And that can whittle away if it's badly done, and I think it is being badly done at the moment, can whittle away the American resolve to sit this thing out. And I am absolutely convinced that if this goes on like this, and if the media, especially the television, persist in reporting it this way, you will find a point where politicians, irresponsible politicians, I believe, and also irresponsible media people will make use of it and say, well, you know, it's better to get out of there. We have no business being in there. We didn't have any business being there in there in the first place. That's what they say. It's not my my view. And so therefore, then you have something analogous to what has happened much, much later in the Vietnam War. That is my principal concern here.
Now, does a comparison bear if someone says, look, Iraq is the same kind of quagmire situation that Vietnam was? Would you accept that comparison?
It can become a quagmire if, for the reasons that I mentioned. You know, it's shaky ground. It's a morass. It is not the same way as in Vietnam, because in Vietnam, to begin with, you had no resolve on the side of the American government. I think the Americans did not support their troops properly. American public weren't behind it, at least not later on. And what's more, in Vietnam, on the other side, you had a very well-structured organization, the Communist Party of North Vietnam, which again was a client of the Soviet Union. None of this, of course, you have in Iraq at the moment.
And in terms of the sheer numbers, you mentioned the kind of, and this is, you know, something not to be demeaned in any sense or belittled in any sense. We are suffering casualties there on a regular basis. But in terms of the numbers of casualties, is there any comparison, Uwe?
Well, not yet. No, there isn't. And of course not. I mean, in Vietnam, you had casualties all the time. But it is, you know, it's the constant drip that provides the danger. And, of course, much as I love you Americans, there is a tendency of Americans to become impatient with something or get bored with something. And that is a weakness, and this is what I fear, that they would say at some point, well, you know, we're losing one or two or three, we're not getting anywhere. And these guys are so corrupt over there, and they're not Swiss, or I don't know what, you know, they don't look like Canadians. And there is this whole issue of we are fighting on the wrong side, totally forgotten who the other side would be. That danger is there, especially if the media and, of course, the politicians aren't very, very careful in what they're doing. Right now, I think President Bush has said the right thing. We are in there for the long run, and we are going to sit it out. I hope he'll have following on this.
What about the peace movement? Now, the peace movement per se, with connection to the Iraq conflict, seemed to have dried up a bit. But we've had previous conversations with you, Uwe, where you talk about the peace movement being very, very tied into liberal Christian denomination.
Right.
How does that play into this?
Well, for the moment, there is no such thing as a peace movement except, you know, a few United Methodist or ELCA Protestant pastors saying something, but they don't play a major role. But when there is a perception that the public tires of this war or tires of this conflict or doesn't see a way out or sees this as an open ended conflict, trust me, the clergy of these churches and the media and politicians will be whorish enough to jump on that bandwagon.
Another thing you criticized Americans for beyond their impatience, which I completely concur, we want everything done in 20 minutes with commercial breaks, is that they want to be loved.
Yeah, well, that's goofy, isn't it?
Is that a weakness here?
Well, I think it's a total weakness. You don't if you spank your child's bottom, and the child cries, it may have been done out of love, but you may not get instant return of love or something like that. Here we have a very, very clear political task to accomplish, and that is A, to get to stop Saddam Hussein from producing weapons of mass destruction, from murdering his own people, from supporting international terrorism. All these tasks have been accomplished. Whether the public in Iraq love you for it or not is totally immaterial. In the long run and in future, historians will view this as an important act. That's the only thing that matters. In Vietnam, you weren't particularly loved either, at least not by the majority of the people, because Americans, or like all of us, I'm German, we looked strange to them, and we may have acted strangely. But I don't suppose one should have a sort of syrupy approach to world conflict, saying, love me, love me, love me, and we'll win this together. This doesn't work that way. It's not that's ahistorical.
One last question on that, Uwe. What is your assessment of the current media coverage of the war as it is kind of tapered off into this situation we have now?
Well, I do criticize heavily this constant. Every morning I switch on television at 6 o'clock or whenever I get up, and I see the new casualty count. That reminds me of Vietnam. On the other hand, I must tell you that I've read some pretty good stuff in the daily press, including here in Washington, especially here in Washington, both papers here in Washington. So I think there is a well-balanced report. I always have a feeling that the written press is doing and radio are doing a more remarkable job on conflicts like those.
I'd also like to talk to you about an analysis, a column you wrote called Pope Bemoans Godless Europe. You quote from the Pope's document called Ecclesia in Europa, that is the Church in Europe.
Right.
And he talks about a forgetfulness of God that has led to the abandonment of man. What
right.
is the religious state of Europe, according to you and the Pope?
Yeah. Well, you're quite right. The Pope and I agree on this issue here. The religious state is indeed an amnesia. It's a religious an amnesia of God. If, for example, the politicians of Europe deem it necessary to leave mention of Christianity and of God out of the new European constitution, I think we can pretty much assume that we are in a disastrous situation. I am not so sure that we have not actually bottomed out in Europe. I think we may have bottomed out in Europe, especially outside of Germany. Germany is always a little slower on these things. But outside of Germany, there is a major movement afoot to return, to this awful thing called spirituality, but also you can see that there are movements among the churches to return to the Christian roots. It's a very, very slow process, and we are fighting again against the media, which in Europe, and especially in Germany, here I talk about television and not so much the newspapers, are very more often than not anti-Christian. And they are influencing the public in a horrible way.
Now, I remember a little time I spent in Great Britain being rather shocked to see the emptiness of the churches. There were not a small number of churches. There are a great number of churches. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Great Britain is officially a Christian nation with its own state church. But the churches were just plain empty. Is that pretty? I mean, I know that's Great Britain, but is that common throughout the continent too?
Yes, it's common throughout the continent. But be very, very careful. You might find vast stretches of Europe with empty churches, and in fact, most horribly, in places like Holland, for example, churches that have been converted into mosques. But there are areas of Europe, and especially in Germany, but also France and elsewhere, and Britain in particular, where the churches are chock-a-block with young people, with men. And the reason is, first of all, these churches have something to say. You will never find a liberal church, a liberal pastor promoting same-sex unions or that sort of thing, having a full house. He won't even have the house full of homosexuals. Even those won't come. but you will find good Orthodox preachers with huge amounts, huge followings. And I, one in Berlin, for example, Berlin is probably the most atheistic city in the world, in Western Europe at the moment. But actually, there are congregations, especially a Missouri-affiliated congregation, that is bursting in the seams. You don't even know the people that are standing room only. So you can see that the spirit is moving there, but it's moving in a very surprising way. But that, as Lutherans, we should know that. I mean, Luther talked about this extensively.
Earlier in 1999, the same Pope, speaking to a synod of bishops in Europe, talked to European Christians, saying things like, be yourself, rediscover your origins, relive your roots. And he said something there that I've heard you say as well, Uwe, and that is that Europeans, because of forgetting their Christian memory, their heritage, their spiritual roots, live in what he called existential anguish and fear of the future. And you have said in other conversations that fear is a bad counselor.
It's a lousy counselor, and you. I beg you to go to Germany, which really, by the grace of God and good Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, had experienced a miracle, a true miracle, which is now dead. This miracle is no longer. I just got a call this morning from a scientist in Marburg, one of the most ancient universities in Europe. The town of Marburg, which is a pretty town, main streets, all the shops are boarded up, closed up. It looks like in Harlem. Why? Because the economy is down. If you go travel into Germany, you see them all with the corners of their mouth hanging down to their kneecaps because they have no joy. And that is, A, because of the terrible sermons that are being preached from television and the pulpit, and B, they've lost the faith in God. You find areas of Germany and of France which are very joyous, and you can be pretty sure that these areas are also have a very strong Christian presence.
And does this mean then that Europe is a mission field?
Oh, totally. I think that is it is a mission field, but unfortunately, but for people like this ancient Pope, very few recognize this. I mean, there are the mainline churches in Europe. Yes, there are wonderful pastors and bishops who see this, but by and large, they don't think that's a mission field. They think this is superfluous. I mean, they don't even believe, many of them don't even believe in the resurrection or any of the Christian tenets to preach. They are getting a good salary, and that's that. Yeah, Europe is a mission field, and where the churches become aware of this and are acting upon this, there is success. There is a thirst, especially among the young. You only have to see this. I mean, think of this 83-year-old Pope with spittle drooling from his mouth because of Parkinson, his hands shaking. I mean, he's a guy who looks older than anybody's grandfather, and yet wherever he shows up, he attracts hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. Why? Because the guy is authentic, because the guy has credibility, because what he says comes from the heart and comes from his conviction. We may argue with him on theological points, but we know he is not a phony. And that attracts young people.
And to what degree is the decline of the church in much of Europe tied to the fact that the church has for so long been state-sponsored or a state church, where the distinction between the two kingdoms has been blurred?
Well, I'm not so sure of that. State-sponsored, you know how this came about in Germany, for example, and in Britain, in different ways. I think it's less tied to that than it is tied to the spirit of the Enlightenment, and then, of course, 19th century, principally German theology, that really has secularized religion. It's more that than anything else. Obviously, if you get a fat salary, you may become complacent. But this would be very unfair to those faithful pastors who get fat salaries and still preach the gospel. I'm not so sure that that the state-related thing, that the church, state collecting tax for the church, is responsible. On the other hand, because if this were the case, then the free churches would be faring that much better, and that is not the case throughout Germany, for example. I mean, some congregations are doing well, but then some state-related congregations are doing well.
You mentioned that the Enlightenment secularized religion. Explain that for our listeners. What do you mean by that?
Well, the Enlightenment approach, as a result of the Enlightenment, especially the 19th century theology in Germany, tried to rationalize religious dicta and try to interpret the Bible by reason, rather than by faith and by reading this. And as Luther said, reason can tell you that God is, but if reason wants to tell you or presumes to tell you what God is like or who God is, then reason becomes the double sword. And I think this is what we're experiencing now. That is the result of this, I mean, right now, to the utter perversion of the Christian doctrine, which you experience in this country as well. You just have to see, or in Canada, you just have to see that.
Roland is calling from his car. Roland, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good evening. Uwe, by far, you are my favorite guest. I'm always so thankful when they've got you on the air.
Thank you.
The complexion of the German church and the churches in Germany that are making strides. My father is from a small town outside of Erfurt, Jena, and that area, Lutheran.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Last time they went back, the Protestant churches are empty, but because of all the Poles and Czechs and whoever who've now come to eastern Germany seeking fortune, the Catholic Church seems to be growing in those areas to the diminishment of the Protestant, the Lutheran Church. And then also I've read that the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses are making remarkable strides in membership in Germany as well.
You're quite right, Roland. Now, for the former, there is one reason. The churches were asleep at the time of the peaceful revolution, which they themselves had actually instigated in many ways or been tools of. I'm talking about the Protestant churches now. And instead of now moving forward and starting to evangelize, including, of course, immediately instituting chaplaincies in the eastern in the armed forces in eastern Germany, they dawdled. Well, the Romans went straight in. They had a plan. They were strategists. They were thinkers. And you now still see Lutheran pastors in Thuringia, where your father is from, or in Saxony, sitting on their hands and pondering their belly buttons instead of going for it. This is not the case all over the country, but it is the case, and this is why you in Jena and places like that, you may have 25% church membership, and that's it.
Finally, you've also written on the issue of the shifting faith of American Hispanics. I read several weeks ago that Hispanics are officially now the largest minority in the United States.
Right.
Are they becoming less Catholic?
Well, yes and no. I mean, many of them are going over to the second generation in particular, first and second generation of immigrants going over to Catholicism, evangelical Protestantism. And then the third generation, that's what peters out, and you find that then, of course, the Catholics are taking over again, or mainline Protestant church again. For example, we have a Hispanic Lutheran congregation here, but I have a feeling that not very much is being done to attract them. So they fall into the hands. I wouldn't belittle that of Pentecostals mainly, and very good people there too. I know some of their pastors. But there is always the danger, I think, that I've heard elsewhere in the world, for example, Japan, that that Pentecostalism tends to become a straw fire. And so then ultimately it may not last another generation or two. And then, of course, the established churches, in this particular case the Roman Catholic Church, seem to be taking over again.
And what impact do you believe this shift of faith, because they're not becoming less Christian per se, they, or I guess less theist, they are one of the most God-believing minorities in the United States. What impact do you think this will have on other things?
I think it will have a huge impact. I think it's an absolute blessing to the United States, to Americans, as they drifted away from the Anglo-Saxons, especially with a self-hatred sometimes and self-destructiveness and aborting their children. God knows, all these terrible things that happened in the name of liberalism. And in come these people from the South, and return to the United States Christianity and Christian values. And in the middle of the century, you're going to have 100 million Hispanics here, most of whom will probably be Orthodox Christians and hold Orthodox Christian values, because, curiously enough, the third generation of Hispanics coming in here are more Christian and more Orthodox than their parents' generation. And only marginally less than their grandparents' generation. So this is quite a remarkable thing. I found that also in the dialogue between Catholics and evangelicals, you will find that the Hispanics are going to continue this, because in my discussions, in my research, I mean, this research is continuing. In my research, I have found that there are fantastically competent both Protestant and Catholic theologians among Hispanics. Evangelicals here in that particular sense.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you very much for being our guest again
thank
on Issues, Etc. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He is also editor of the new book titled One Incarnate Truth. You can get information on this book at www.cph.org, that's cph.org, or by calling Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is edited by our guest, Uwe Simonetto. The book is called One Incarnate Truth. When we come back tomorrow, there's no more breaks. It's time to stop the show. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Martin Nolan joins us here in Studio A. American civil religion. Is it the same thing as Christianity? We'll talk about that tomorrow on the program. Is America a Christian nation? What is civil religion? Does Christianity exist to serve the state? We'll talk about it tomorrow. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.